Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un make it official.
Russia's the first country, basically since the collapse of the Soviet Union, that's been willing to offer North Korea, military cooperation.
Plus, tension on Israel's northern borders tied to events in Gaza.
Hezbollah is jeopardizing the future of Lebanon so that it can be a shield for Hamas.
And later, an update from Kyiv, trouble between Russia and Iran, and a look at the global heat wave. Today is Wednesday, June 19th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on Tuesday that the U.S. is still trying to bridge the gaps on Gaza ceasefire talks, and he puts the blame squarely on Hamas for the delays in seeing results.
I'll just remind everyone once again that the entire world came together behind the proposal that President Biden laid out a few weeks ago. The entire world, with one exception, and that was Hamas. Hamas came back after everyone else had said yes, including Israel, reconfirmed to me by Prime Minister Netanyahu when I was in Israel. Hamas came back with new conditions, new demands, including demands and conditions that actually went beyond what it had already previously accepted. So we're working to see if we can bridge the gaps that Hamas has now created by not saying yes to the proposal that everyone else had agreed to, that was endorsed by the United Nations Security Council, countries around the world, and we have the negotiators, the mediators, Egypt, Qatar in particular, working on this to see if we can bridge the gap.
Blinken said that a shipment of 900-kilogram bombs that had been withheld from Israel out of concern for the well-being of Palestinians in Gaza was still under review by the U.S. This is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Blinken had assured him the Biden administration was working to cancel restrictions on arms deliveries to Israel. Speaking on the withholding of the bombs, Blinken said it's to protect innocent civilians, and he added that Hamas has an obligation to protect innocent civilians as well.
We have to, all of us, put the interests of these many, many innocent families and people first and foremost, and that means that Israel has to do more, continue to do much more, to protect civilians, to make sure that they get the assistance they need. But it first and foremost means that Hamas has to make a decision. Is it actually looking out for the interests of Palestinian people? Is it looking out for its own interests at the expense of the interests of Palestinians who are suffering every single minute?
And as tensions between Israel and Hamas are showing no signs of easing, tensions between Israel and Hezbollah to the north are on the rise as well. U.S. negotiator Amos Hochstein is back in the Middle East as Israel and Hezbollah seem to be on the brink of an all-out war, a war that would be devastating for both Israel and Lebanon. But ceasefire seems to be tied to the fighting in Gaza. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israel and Hezbollah seem to be closer than ever to a full-blown war, with escalating attacks on both sides against civilian and military targets.
Daniel Hagari is the Israeli army spokesman.
Hezbollah's increasing aggression is bringing us to the brink of what could be a wider escalation, one that could have devastating consequences for Lebanon and the entire region. Hezbollah is jeopardizing the future of Lebanon, so that it can be a shield for Hamas.
Some Israeli analysts say the two sides are already at war.
Avraham Levine is from the Alma Center, an Israeli think tank specializing in Lebanon.
What kind of war are we going to see in the future? But currently, we're in a full-scale war, only in the artillery aspect and not a ground maneuver yet.
Tens of thousands of Israelis and Lebanese have been forced to leave their homes near the border. Israeli analysts say a full-scale war with Hezbollah would take a larger toll than the 8 months of fighting Hamas in Gaza.
Eli Carmon is a senior researcher at the International Institute for Counterterrorism.
From the point of view of Hezbollah, this means a huge missile war by firing the 150,000 missiles they have, including precision missiles that can hit every objective in Israel, military, civilian, strategic, but also practically every urban area in Israel, and therefore producing a huge, huge damage, material and victims.
Israel has warned the Lebanese government that the whole country, not just Hezbollah in the south, would suffer heavy damage in an Israeli bombardment. Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah says any deal to end the fighting with Israel is tied to a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza.
He says he hopes the war will stop, but that if Netanyahu insists on war, he will cause a disaster for what Nasrallah called the Zionist entity.
More than 8 months since the war between Israel and Hamas began in Gaza, the chances of the war expanding to a second front seem to be growing. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Shifting our attention to Russia and Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he's seeing positive results after allies have given permission to use Western weapons to strike military targets inside Russia. Meanwhile, the situation in the Kharkiv region is getting worse. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
In his evening address on June 18th, the President of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, said that the permission to use Western weapons to strike military targets on the territory of Russia is working exactly as Ukraine expected.
Ми бачимо, як рішучість світу відкриває нові перспективи для відновлення нашої.
He noted the destruction of Russian positions and missile launchers near the border and the difference it makes for Ukrainian defense. Zelensky also said that Ukraine continues to prepare the next diplomatic steps to restore peace, such as activities between the first and second peace summits. Ukraine plans to organize a second peace summit and involve even more participants in joint work on the points of the peace formula and the development of concrete steps to restore security and peace. Meanwhile, the situation in the Kharkiv region remains very tense. In Vovchansk, the front line is stabilized along the Vovcha River. The street fights in the city have been happening around the clock for the past weeks. The area near Kupiansk remains a higher priority for the Russian forces than the offensive in the north of the region, but the Russians have not made significant progress there in the past weeks. Russian troops are raising reserves. The situation is becoming more complicated in the Burova region, where, according to Ukrainian analysts, around 10,000 Russian troops have already accumulated. The civilian population has been informed to prepare for a possible new offensive and to evacuate if necessary. The situation in the Ukrainian energy sector remains critical. All regions of Ukraine are operating according to the electricity schedules that provide Ukrainians with electricity for an average of every 4 hours per day. According to experts, if Russia continues airstrikes on the Ukrainian power sector, the worst-case scenario is that Ukrainians can spend up to 20 hours a day without electricity and heating in winter. One of the main issues is that Ukrainian thermal and hydroelectric power plants are difficult and expensive to repair. According to Ukrainian energy officials, it will take years to repair some of them, while others may never be restored. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. It's hot. Are recent heat waves a quirk of the weather or an indication of more severe climate change? We'll find out in a moment. First, though, Russian President Vladimir Putin's visit to North Korea represents an upgrade in the relationship between the two countries, an analyst told Reuters on Tuesday, and could offer Pyongyang significant economic and military benefits. Ryan Chang of Reuters has more.
Russian President Vladimir Putin touched down in North Korea late Tuesday and was warmly embraced by leader Kim Jong-un on the tarmac. Putin's welcome didn't end there. State media footage showed his portraits and Russian flags across Pyongyang, with buildings lit with messages welcoming him to the North Korean capital, where he last visited 24 years ago. The Russian president's trip looks set to reshape decades of Russia-North Korea relations. It comes when both countries face international isolation, and analyst Jenny Towns, senior fellow at Washington, D.C.'s Stimson Center, says it should raise alarms about how much Moscow's willing to help the reclusive nuclear-armed state.
They have a common problem, and that is sanctions. And Putin has really been leading what he considers and what he deems the war on the West in trying to create a multipolar system and sort of upend or create an alternative to a U.S.-led world order.
North Korea stands to gain a lot from this relationship. In the short term, more trade with Russia could cement agricultural cooperation or Russia's willingness to receive North Korean workers again, says Town. But militarily as well, it's a boon for Pyongyang.
Russia is the first country, basically since the collapse of the Soviet Union, that's been willing to offer North Korea, military cooperation. And so this does give North Korea opportunities to upgrade their hardware in their conventional side, as well as their military reconnaissance satellites and their space programs, which Russia has said openly that they'd be willing to do.
And Washington is watching. Pentagon spokesperson Major General Pat Ryder on Tuesday voiced U.S. worries over Moscow's overtures to Pyongyang.
The deepening cooperation between Russia and the DPRK is something that should be of concern, especially to anyone that's interested in maintaining peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula.
Ryder also noted that North Korea has been selling arms to Russia. The North's missile and nuclear programs are banned by UN Security Council resolutions. Putin praised North Korea ahead of his arrival for resisting what he said was U.S. economic pressure, blackmail, and threats.
That's Ryan Chang of Reuters reporting for us. And also on Wednesday, Putin and Kim gave joint statements in Pyongyang announcing the signing of a strategic partnership pact that includes a mutual defense clause. Putin said that under the clause, each country has agreed to help the other repel what he called external aggression. He also called attention to statements made by the U.S. and other NATO countries, which agreed to let Ukraine strike targets inside Russia with Western-supplied weapons. Also at the conference, Kim said the two countries' relations have been elevated to a new, high level of alliance. Kim said the pact would expand cooperation between the two countries, calling it strictly peace-loving and defensive in nature. Also, Putin gifted Kim with a Russian-made limousine, which they took for a drive together. A reaction from China, North Korea's main political and economic benefactor, and an increasingly important ally for Moscow, has not been heard. As the Russia-North Korea relationship is getting stronger, the Russia-Iran relationship is hitting a rocky patch. Following years of military and economic cooperation between the two anti-Western powers, Russian Foreign Ministry official Zamir Kabulov gave an interview to a Russian news agency on June 11th. He said long-running negotiations for a cooperation agreement with Iran have been suspended because of unspecified problems on the Iranian side. A Kremlin spokesman linked the delay to Iran's focus on staging special elections following the death of President Raisi, but Iranian officials say they want a deal as soon as possible. Nicole Graevsky is a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a specialist on Iran-Russia ties. My colleague Michael Lippin asked her what's behind the latest tension in the relationship.
So essentially, the Russians, I think, were trying to reap a lot more concessions from the Iranians. This is from what I've heard from at least people within Iran. And I've been reading this in the press as well, but mostly it has to do with certain economic arrangements. So either Russia having a permanent grain presence in the southern Iranian ports, or issues with maybe Russian overflight rights when it comes to military issues. I think those were like the big issues that the Iranians were quite frustrated with. The Iranians also didn't want the agreement to be more than, I guess, 15 to 20 years, and the Russians were pushing for a longer, more comprehensive agreement. And I think that's really interesting because I don't think that would have been the case if it wasn't for the war in Ukraine. And I think the Russians are frustrated, and I think the Iranians were already frustrated. But I think the statement that came from Khabibullah, what might be perceived as Russian frustration, might have derived from the Iranian position, which came from the upcoming presidential elections. And I assume that the foreign ministry thinks that whatever factions ends up being elected in Iran might be able to either modify the deal or would want to have certain provisions of the deal more receptive to their position on Russia.
So can I ask about that Russian, let's say, fear or anxiety that Iran might adjust its position with a new president coming into office? Where was the last president who died in the helicopter crash, Raisi? Where was he on this deal? And how much different could Iran's position get with a new president?
So Raisi really tied his legitimacy to the Russians. I think Raisi's first real foreign policy victory was Iran's accession to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. But throughout his presidency, he's used the Russians as kind of a token of legitimacy to the population, even though there's a lot of societal discontent. I think you could see a change in this. And I think it's really interesting, actually, brought this up about the next coming administration. On one hand, you could see hardliners seizing power like Jalili, who might be more inclined to be conciliatory towards the Russians.
You're talking about Saeed Jalili.
Yes. And then there's also the reformists. And the reformists have historically been a lot more reticent towards cooperation with Russia. And if they do manage to win in this election, however unlikely that may be, there might be a recalibration.
So that's what you're saying Russia might be concerned about, that a new Iranian administration might want to move a bit more toward the West.
Yeah, move toward the West, or even, you know, some kind of form of the JCPOA. Some kind of new nuclear agreement perhaps is on the table with a new reformist presidency. And I think that is also a concern for the Russians, partly because I think within Russia, the view is that an Iran that is less encumbered by sanctions and an Iran that is less isolated is less inclined to provide drones to Russia, to this kind of, you know, unequivocal support to the Russian war effort in Ukraine.
Well, if you can look in your crystal ball, this comprehensive agreement that's been in the works between Iran and Russia, it's been in the final stage. Foreign Minister Lavrov said it was in a final stage about 2 years ago, and it's still in a final stage. How much longer do you think it's going to take?
I wouldn't expect this agreement to be signed the first day that the next Iranian president comes into office. I don't think that's really on the future trajectory. However, I do think that it's important for both the Russians and the Iranians. And I think that the Iranians would try to reap more concessions from the Russians. I could see it maybe within 2 to 3 years, maybe a year at the least, being signed and finalized. But it really just matters on the extent of it.
And finally today, it's hot. In some places, deadly hot. Hundreds of pilgrims participating in the Hajj in Mecca have died from the heat, more than 51 degrees at times. Several tourists have perished from the heat in Greece. Rajasthan and northwestern India saw temperatures above 50 degrees. It's 34 degrees in Rome and nearly 38 degrees in Cairo. It's close to 40 degrees in Phoenix, Arizona. And right here at the VOA headquarters in Washington, it's a tick over 32 degrees, which is way above normal for this time of year. So what's behind this heat wave that seems to have taken over the world? To find out, I'm speaking with Christina Dahl. She's a climate scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists.
So what we're seeing here is heat waves just happening from place to place across the globe, made more likely and made hotter because of climate change.
We've been watching the climate news, and folks have been saying that if the temperature would increase by a degree and a half or even 2 degrees Celsius, that all kinds of terrible things would happen in the world. the temperatures are a lot higher now than 1 or 2 degrees above normal. So what's the difference there?
Yeah, when you hear people talk about the importance of not warming the planet by more than 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius, what they're talking about is the global average temperature over a long time period. What we're seeing when we see a big record-breaking heat wave is, you know, sometimes temperatures that are 5 or 10 degrees C hotter than normal. But those temperatures only last a few days typically. So we're looking at kind of two different timescales. When we think about the worst case scenarios for climate change, we're looking at the global average and it being much warmer over a significant period of time.
If climate change is really a man-made issue, if human technology, human industry, human pollution is responsible for these rising temperatures, what is the specific mechanism? How are the gases in the atmosphere, how are the chemicals on Earth making the temperature warmer? What is happening up there?
Yeah, so as we do things like burn fossil fuels like coal, oil, and gas, the burning of those fuels releases carbon dioxide and methane, and other heat-trapping gases. When those gases are in the atmosphere, they trap heat that radiates out of the Earth, that's trying to make its way back out into the atmosphere. And they essentially trap it in like a blanket would keep you warm.
So if we were to stop producing those gases, they would eventually dissipate and release more of the Earth's heat, returning it to a more natural temperature cycle.
That's right. For something like extreme heat, it's actually very responsive to changes in our emissions. And the research my colleagues and I have done suggests that if we were to reduce our emissions quickly and steeply, we could potentially see no more rise in extreme heat events starting by mid-century or so. So it could take a couple decades to see the effects of that when it comes to our temperature and extreme heat events, but it wouldn't take, all that long.
We've talked about the big picture, how heat is affecting climate in the world. On an individual level, though, how can people prepare for the heat? What should they be looking for as signals from their body that something is wrong?
Yeah, first and foremost, we need to all recognize that heat can be deadly. We often underestimate its power because it's not something dramatic like a wildfire or a hurricane. But heat kills more people, at least in the United States, in an average year than any other type of extreme weather. And so what you need to look out for in your body is some of the early warning signs, things like feeling fatigued, feeling like you're getting a headache or confused or a little dizzy. And if you start to feel those things, try to get somewhere where you can be cooling down. Stop gardening outside. Stop mowing the lawn. Stop running around. Stop working if you can. Get somewhere cool. Rest and drink water. If those symptoms start to worsen, things like falling down or fainting, definitely start to seek medical attention.
Christina Dahl is the principal climate scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Dr. Dahl, thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.